This is the Winchester Talking Newspaper for the week ending Friday, June the 20th, 2014. Hello and a very warm welcome to you for this week's edition of the Winchester and District Talking Newspaper. We have extracts for you from the Hampshire Chronicle for the week ending Friday, 20th of June, 2014. Keith and Linda Vincent are your editors for this week. This week your readers are Claire Porter.
Hello.
Robin Freeman.
Hello.
And Gerry Tuff.
Hello.
And I'm your presenter for today, Ros Lydiard. As usual, we'll begin with the main headlines, which this week are School bans high energy drinks, Bullington Cross wind farm plan thrown out, and Silver Hill will ruin city forevermore. Now, Claire, will you start us off with the first headline story, please?
School bans high energy drinks, heads concern over effects. A Winchester comprehensive has banned high energy drinks amid fears they are affecting the behaviour and performance of pupils. Matthew Leeming, head teacher at King's School, has banned highly caffeinated and sugary drinks such as Red Bull and Lucozade. He has written to parents saying, "We are worried about the effects on pupils' heart rate, behaviour and focus in lessons." Some of the 680ml cans contain the equivalent of 21 teaspoons of sugar and as much caffeine as 3 cups of coffee. Pupils now face a detention if they are caught with drinks such as Monster, Red Bull and Relentless. King's is believed to be among the first schools in Hampshire to ban the beverages. Mr. Leeming's crackdown has come just months after government adviser John Vincent called for them to be banned from schools, saying the drinks were effectively another form of drugs. Mr. Leeming said, "Pupils are walking into school with these drinks in the morning and they are quite expensive, so we are worried they are spending a proportion of their lunch money on them instead of buying a nutritious meal. There is plenty of evidence to suggest if you drink these highly energy drinks, you are less mentally and emotionally involved, particularly as the day goes on." Mr. Leeming said the ban was the idea of a head of year who noticed some children were more hyper than usual. The aim was also to educate pupils and parents, he said. "I would not want my children consuming 21 teaspoons of sugar in one go." The head said any pupil seen with an energy drink will have it confiscated, and children found flouting the ban face a lunchtime detention. The school, which caters for 1,650 pupils aged between 11 and 16, has just been rated outstanding in all areas after an Ofsted inspection this month. Meanwhile, four pupils at Barton Peveril College in Eastleigh tackled the issue as part of an AS level in health and social care after discovering students were drinking up to 6 cans per day. Dave Macy, 17, said, "Loads of students start the day with a can of Monster, one of the strongest energy drinks around. The sugar in an apple will be more effective in keeping them awake, but I know plenty of people who are drinking at least 2 cans of this stuff every day. I heard of some who drank 6 cans to pull an all-nighter. They were playing a new video game. One girl told me she couldn't get out of bed in the morning without an energy drink. If there wasn't one, she would get her mum to buy one." Julia Kudzia, also 17, added, "It's really important that we tackle the caffeine issues. It's a drug, just like alcohol or tobacco. yet so few people take its side effects seriously. The students designed a health promotion campaign to highlight the dangers after finding none online. They compared the sugar content in a Monster drink to 4 slices of cheesecake and caffeine to several cans of Coke. Then they set up a stall on campus giving out free decaffeinated coffee. Barton Peverill College stopped selling energy drinks a couple of years ago, but the popular brands can be bought for £1 within 300 metres of the school. A college spokesman said, "We don't sell these drinks on campus, but that doesn't mean we don't find empty cans in bins because the students can buy them elsewhere." Currently, manufacturers and retailers have a voluntary ban on the sale of drinks to under-16s, but there is no law to stop children buying them. The Food Standards Agency advises that children limit their intake of drinks that are high in caffeine, saying the drinks could lead potentially to short-term effects such as increased excitability, irritability, and nervousness or anxiety. Peter Simmons College does sell high-energy cans on campus, but a spokesman said this was under review, adding, "As part of our health and well-being program, we aim to make our students aware of the dangers of caffeine overdose, which includes sleeping issues and lack of concentration."
Bullington Cross Wind Farm Plan Thrown Out. A wind farm developer is considering their options after its scheme for Bullington Cross was rejected by councillors. EDF Energy Renewables wanted to put up 14 turbines near where the A303 and A34 dual carriageways intersect north of Winchester. But councillors from 3 authorities voted to support officers' recommendations to refuse the application. An appeal now looks likely. A spokesman for EDF Energy Renewables said, "We are naturally disappointed at the decisions taken by the councils involved. The scheme has attracted high levels of support and encouragement from the local community, and in particular from the Hampshire Renewable Energy Cooperative. Thousands of letters of local support have been registered with the councils that recognise the importance and merits of the proposal. We will now carefully review the grounds for this decision and consider our options for going forward." Winchester City Councillor Therese Evans told the Planning Committee, "The City Council has policies on energy, but we also have policies on landscapes, and that is the overriding factor. They are the way forward, and we need to reduce our dependence on other fuels, but I don't think this is the appropriate site." Supporters said the scheme would boost the local economy, draw in £5 million in additional rates over the 20 years of the project's duration, as well as £140,000 per year from EDF for community projects. Britain has a national target of producing 30% of its electricity from renewable resources by 2020. If the blades rotated constantly, the farm would have been capable of generating 62 gigawatt hours of electricity per year, or 8% of the needs of the 3 districts, Winchester, Basingstoke and Test Valley, and would have been as tall as the spire of Salisbury Cathedral and visible for up to 35 kilometres. Douglas Patterson, chairman of Keep Hampshire Green, said, "Obviously, we are hugely relieved with the decision. There are mixed emotions, to be honest. I find myself very angry that we've all been put through this, but I'm very grateful that the councils can see through that which they have been fed." Lucy Dowson of South Wanston Parish Council said, "We're delighted that there are 3 planning authorities who listen to the recommendations of the planning officers and listen to local residents. In a rare move, members from 3 planning committees attended the meeting at Winchester Guildhall on Monday as the applications straddled land overseen by the three authorities. Winchester City Council received 1,785 letters supporting the scheme, as well as 1,358 letters of objection. Martin Heath, director of Hampshire Renewable Energy Co-op, which organised the pro-lobby, said, "Clearly this is a great disappointment to us and to the many volunteers that helped us out over the past 13 months. A lot of hard work has been put into getting a community ownership of the wind farm. Many more people supported the wind farm than opposed it, but still our councillors don't get it. The biggest danger to us, our ecology and our wildlife, is global warming. Somehow our councillors think it is wind farms that are dangerous. A demonstration in favour of the development was held prior to the meeting as councillors and public filed into the Bapsey Hall. Supporter Alan Walker told the meeting, "I feel that the officer's report doesn't make enough of the benefits that may accrue from the development." But Councillor Stephen Jeffrey, who represents Wanston and Mitcheldeva, said a large proportion of the business rates earned from the scheme would go straight to central government. He said that individuals who invested in the cooperative project, by which profits of the development were channeled back to investors, were no more than speculators seeking to make money from a major industrial facility dropped into the middle of the countryside. Among the main objectors were the Ministry of Defence and the nearby Popham Airfield. Surveys found bats, including the high-risk species Noctule and Leisler's, living in and around the site, as well as dormice, which have strict legal protection.
Silver Hill will ruin city forevermore. A campaign has been launched to stop the £150 million Silver Hill development in Winchester city centre. Councillor Kim Gottlieb says the scheme for homes and shops will be the ruin of Winchester forevermore and has urged the City Council to think again. Councillor Gottlieb, a member of the ruling Conservative group, told the Chronicle, "This scheme is fundamentally wrong. This is a fabulous opportunity we are blowing." He has produced 1,000 glossy booklets outlining his concerns over the revamp of the rundown area between the Friars Gate and the Broadway. "The architecture is dull and uninspiring," he says, "and the mainly 6- and 7-storey building will loom over the city centre. It will tower over even the Brooks, which, from a design perspective, will look like a piece of classical architecture by comparison." "The Silver Hill scheme will suck customers away from the high street and is outdated," he said. "At a time when virtually every other high street is figuring how to survive years of onslaught by the growth of out-of-town retailing, covered malls and the internet, Winchester is promoting a scheme that will take the centre of gravity away from its own high street and emasculate it." Councillor Gottlieb, himself a developer and chartered surveyor, has launched a campaign now because the developer Henderson wishes to make changes to the plans that already have planning permission, including dropping the bus station and most of the affordable housing. He said, "Because Henderson wants to make significant changes to the consented scheme, the council is in a strong position to negotiate. If it wills, the council can make all the changes that are needed to be made to ensure that this important regeneration project is a success for the city. It is wrong to assume that it's all too late and that the development cannot be changed." Councillor Gottlieb, who represents the Itchen Valley, has started a website and Twitter feed to gain public support. The website had more than 1,500 unique users by Tuesday. He wants to see a smaller scheme, more in line with the council's own planning brief from 2003, which called for sympathetic regeneration of the area. Winchester shouldn't be in the game of trying to compete with retailing in Southampton or Basingstoke. Retailing is not what Winchester is about. It's about heritage and culture and charm, and about being different from other cities, he added. Councillor leader Rob Humby said, Councillor Godlieb has a right to his opinion. I don't think his views are shared by the majority of other councillors and outside bodies, such as the Business Improvement District. He was a member of the reference group and had a chance to have input. A lot of its ideas came from him. His website does not make it clear that Silver Hill already has planning approval. Councillor Humby added the council had taken legal advice, including from a QC, that said the council had less room for manoeuvre with Henderson than Mr. Godlieb asserted. There is a limit to the amount of changes we can make. Councillor Humby added, the new planning application will be for the planning committee. Everyone will have a chance to have their input. It's wrong to say we've been rushing it. It's been going on for 17 years now. To make the changes now could set things back years and years.
Thank you, everyone. And following those headlines, we're going to read for you the death announcements for the week ending Friday, 20th of June. Brown, Michael Terence Charlie Brown, on the 12th of June.
North, Margaret North, on the 9th of June.
Patience, Sally Patience, on the 7th of May, after a short illness.
Ponsford, Leo George Ponsford, peacefully on 4th of June.
Thomas, Andrew Thomas. Suddenly, while holiday walking in the Pyrenees, aged 63.
Redhead, Michael Brian Redhead, suddenly but peacefully on the 4th of June, aged 67.
Ridgway, John Francis Ridgway, peacefully in hospital on the 14th of June, aged 83.
West, Lawrence West, peacefully at home on 10th of June, aged 73.
Sherratt, Victor John Vic Sherratt, suddenly at home on the 9th of June, aged 69.
Williams, Roy Williams, peacefully at home on the 9th of June, aged 90.
And Claire is going to read for us a Christian comment,
which this week is entitled, Trinity Tells Us That God Is With Us in All This, and it's written by Mary Gray. The Holy Trinity, Feast of the Mystery of God, what does it say to us today? St. Patrick, speaking to the Irish people centuries ago, used a three-leaved shamrock to explain it. Three joints in the finger, yet one finger fair. Three leaves of the shamrock, yet only one shamrock to wear. The Russian Orthodox Church uses icons to point to God's mystery. St. Augustine wandered along the seashore, pondering the mystery of Trinity, when he met a little child. "What are you so worried about?" asked the child. Of course, it was a vision of the Christ child. When Augustine said it was the mystery of God as three in one, the child said, "Look, can you count these grains of sand on the seashore? Just as you cannot grasp the mystery of God." But a bigger problem is we take it for granted. Is it just a quick formula that we mutter in the name of the Father? One writer even said, "The Trinity is like the old piano in the parlour. We dust it from time to time, respect it, but never play it." Others speak of it jokingly. It means God as two men and a pigeon. Actually, the belief in God as three in one arose not as dry doctrine, but as an experience of God for ordinary Christians. Jesus, in constant communion with God, source of life and being, sending the Spirit, energizer and consoler. Early Christians experienced baptism as a threefold immersion in the waters, emerging shivering, with the threefold name of God ringing in their ears as they stammered their first confession of faith. Trinity tells us that our God is a God in movement, dynamic, never static. You cannot tie God down. God is beyond gender, male or female, beyond any human boundary. As Jesus was, so God is, full of compassion and deeply involved with us and our healing. Trinity says that God is fully involved with our pain, the pain of all creatures, and the global struggles for healing and justice. God is a God of interrelatedness and interdependence. We may be going through failure of relation, breakdown of relation, suffering loneliness, disillusionment, loss and sickness. Trinity tells us that God is with us in all this, that suffering entered the heart of God too, the bread that God shares with creation. But Trinity embraces difference too. We saw an icon of Trinity and difference when Pope Francis prayed with Presidents Shimon Peres and Mahmoud Abbas of Israel, Palestine, and a candle of hope was lit in what appeared to be a moonless night. And that was written by Mary Gray.
Thank you, Claire. It's time for letters to the editor now. And for the first three, we'll hear how the Silver Hill development in Winchester is still causing concern. Robin's going to start us off, please. Thank you.
This one is from Simon Morrison of St John Street, Winchester, and has the title, Scheme is Too Far from Original Plan. My wife, Joanne, and I would like to express our alarm at the Silver Hill proposals as outlined in the Winchester Deserves Better website. Although we do try to keep abreast of local affairs, this one slipped by, and we were unaware until last weekend that substantial changes were proposed, or that approval might be imminent. This scheme is not what was proposed back in 2003. We can't disagree with any of the issues on the website winchesterdeservesbetter.com. We're both especially concerned about the lack of a proper bus station, not least as the Broadway is being increasingly used by intercity and tourist coaches. Residents' parking around here is already oversubscribed and is put under extra pressure during local events, e.g. Christmas. So an inadequate supply of parking by the scheme will be unwelcome, to say the least. We understand that there is an important council meeting on this subject coming up, and would like to register our voices to help prevent this scheme being changed so far from its original form. Simon Morrison, St John Street, Winchester.
Silver Hill again, this one from Arthur Morgan, headed, This Scheme Could Be Another Brooks. In your gently facetious Belgarum vignette of the Silver Hill development, the concluding suggestion, surely there must be some error, is far nearer the dismal truth. To pick up on your totalitarian inference, Winchester grad, this development will be a brutally massive citadel-like structure imposing itself over the city, a cuckoo in the nest. Allies and Morrison no doubt used their architectural ingenuity to problem-solve a complex site, but important questions remain. Has the brief been fully addressed? Was it brought up to date in our changed economic climate? And does it truly reflect the heritage of our wonderful historic city? Those issues apart, the devil is not always in the detail, but in the bigger picture and its implications. The Guildhall exhibition offered inadequate time and information to present an honest picture of the mass of the two main blocks. There was no model, and one can now see why, for it would show immediately the incongruity of scale and style these immense, intimidating blocks would have on the heart of the city, both metaphorical and actual. Pedestrians should visualise the blocks in three dimensions and sense the excessively tall facades, taller than the bell tower over the brooks, lowering over three narrow streets, potential wind tunnels with restricted sunlight and little softening landscaping. In a word, blockscape. The Brook Centre has been called a folly, a retail failure. Silver Hill, in its present proposal, could be another, but of colossal proportions, a tragic light on our city. See Councillor Kim Gottlieb's important and succinct analysis on www.winchesterdeservesbetter.com. A decision is now imminent. Impatience, however, can lead to expediency, and to impose this scheme would surely be forever regretted. Our councillors and officers should give this project essential reconsideration and negotiate with the developers Henderson towards a solution better suited to our needs and our city's heritage. Arthur Morgan, Edgar Road, Winchester.
And this letter is another on Silver Hill from Russell Webb. As a fifth-generation Wintonian, I am appalled by the current Silver Hill plans, which are clearly based on cramming in as much as possible to maximise financial gain for the developer, without giving the needs of our precious city a second thought. No right-thinking person would consider this potential blot an enhancement to our beautiful landscape. Indeed, no development at all would be preferable to this. A huge mistake was made in allowing the Brooks, another monstrosity. So let us do all what we can to prevent another, even bigger mistake from being made by stopping the Silver Hill proposal in its tracks and starting again. This part of Winchester needs development designed to blend with the existing fabric of the city, not stand out like a sore thumb. With current proposals, the view of the city from any vantage point, whether on the ground in High Street, Westgate, St Giles Hill, St Catherine's Hill, or wherever, will be dominated by oversized, inappropriately designed buildings. Contemporary architecture can be beautiful and can enhance the quality of the built environment, or it can ruin it. Similarly, traditional designs can enhance the beauty and character of its location, or it can look like a fake trying to emulate the historic nature of what already exists around it. Either way, for Silver Hill, the chosen scheme needs to complement, not loom over and dominate our beautiful city, whose very heart stands to be destroyed forevermore by a large, ill-considered development in such a prime location. Russell Webb, Woodman Lane.
This letter from E. Stobart of Woodhall Spa in Lincolnshire is entitled, Why is Hampshire being destroyed? We have for years been holiday visitors to Winchester and its beautiful surrounding countryside and villages. Now we are back at home, I felt I had to write it to express my deep sadness at what is happening to your county from an outsider's perspective. New houses, proposed developments, solar and wind farms, new roads, etc. The need for more housing and for alternative, greener power is understandable, but it has to be in the right place. Hampshire is not the right place. Further north, or offshore, is the only place for wind farms. It is never windy enough in Hampshire anyhow. Living in the south is a seriously expensive exercise. But looking at your towns, villages, countryside, proximity to London, standard of education, etc., it's no wonder house prices are so high. To see it being dismantled breaks our hearts. Living in Hampshire is something many of us can only dream of. Please look after it, as you are at risk of fouling your own nest. We are holidaying in Dorset next year. E. Stobart, Woodhall Spa, Lincolnshire.
This letter from Freddy Crab is headed, Alpacas Were in the Wrong Place. RE the Alpaca Sanctuary and the Attack by Two Runaway Dogs in the Chronicle, June the 12th. We live opposite this farm, a plot of land falsely described on a planning application for a temporary dwelling as larger than it is, and in the South Downs National Park's protected AONB. The field floods, so is unsuitable for stock rearing. More than 50 chickens require a DEFRA licence and inspections. It is not for stockmen to issue orders to dog owners, but for them to maintain good fences. The dogs were not savage or dangerous. Good fences would have kept them out. What is hidden is the truth. The alpacas are in the wrong place. It's easier to move them than to justify a temporary dwelling in an AONB being destroyed by speculative planning applications. SDNPA and Winchester Planning Office, please take note. Freddie Crabb, Hensting Lane, Oslebury.
This letter from Margot Walker is headed, Verge's Vital Part of Rural Ecosystems. Our parish magazine's June issue came with a beautiful picture on the cover showing a country lane near me with verges burgeoning with cow parsley, bluebells, wild garlic and more. Yet within days of the photograph being taken, the council sent vehicles to ruthlessly cut back this lovely and environmentally friendly view. Our wildflowers are food and home to so many species, and now so many farmers use chemicals to keep all weeds clear of crops in the fields, the roadside verges have become a vital part of rural ecosystems. Cow parsley alone has 45 species of insect that use it as a food source. We humans use wild garlic leaves in our salads, and they're free. I believe our own Deputy Lord Lieutenant Alan Titchmarsh has urged councils not to cut the verges until August, in the same way as we await the departure of nesting birds before trimming hedges. In Ireland, it is illegal to cut the verges so early in the year. It is not a road safety issue, as the fully grown verges force motorists to slow down. By cutting them, the commuters are encouraged to drive faster. So why, when we live in a national park, are the park authorities not more conscious of such environmental issues? Or might one imagine they are too busy with this fabulously expensive headquarters in Midhurst to care? Margot Walker, Little Ashton Dairy, Bishop's Waltham.
In his letter, Charles Baslington of Alsford writes about the pressure to build more homes. The emerging local plan, part two for Winchester, shows there is pressure to build more houses. But one question for residents concerned about development near their homes is, will there be enough money to ensure sufficient facilities and that the new work is properly blended in and does not blight the rest of the area? Whilst infrastructure is not cheap, I believe there is enough value from any development to carefully design the new locality and its integration with the existing. This can be determined, and the finances work as follows. Website Zoopla gives the average price in Hampshire for a detached house at about £450,000. Assuming the new homes are built on greenfield sites, the basic land value prior to permission is set by its agricultural use value at about £23,000 per hectare. For the typical density of 35 homes per hectare, this is about £700 per plot. The average house costs around £240,000 to build, including all building work, roads, utilities, finance costs and builder's profit. This means that the profit on a market price home at a £440,000 sale price less costs of £240,000 is £209,000, assuming £1,000 for the land plot. So this value of £209,000 gained on the land through the grant of residential planning permission means that for every five homes, about £1 million is available. As a rule of thumb, we would assume that between 5 and 10 houses raises £1 million of profit to provide enough to meet the Section 106 payments, or Community Infrastructure Levy, amounts for providing recreation, open space, roadworks, landowners' profit, etc. For larger sites, provision of affordable homes is accommodated on site. This is a separate deal with the developer and means a social landlord or housing association buys such purpose-built homes following a set formula which includes land at a much lower value than that achieved on each market-priced house sale. This means the affordability arises from the discounted land value. The builder is fully paid by the social landlord, but the landowner-developer forgoes a highly multiplied land value profit on these homes. Charles Baslington, The Avenue, Alsford.
Another letter from Alsford, this time from Pam Stevens, is entitled "Nothing Tatty About Alsford's Market." I would like to respond to the letter in your issue of June the 5th from James White of Weybridge. Alsford Market has been going since 1215 and has just celebrated its 800 years of markets in Broad Street. Prior to 2009, the market was a bit run down, with only three stalls per week. I then took over the running as a town trustee, and with a great deal of hard work from my colleagues, who went round all the markets giving out cards and information, we now have a bustling market with 17 to 20 stalls a week and a waiting list for stallholders to join. To commemorate 800 years of markets, New Alsford Town Trust has gifted a clock to the town, which is set in a prominent place outside the Swan Hotel. I'm not sure Mr. White really understands the history of Alsford, but I do not have tatty stalls on the market, and we make sure the items the stallholders are selling are good quality. Visitors to the town are always impressed with the friendly nature of the market. Everyone is entitled to their opinion, but I myself, a trustee and market coordinator, take offence at this letter, especially as we are all volunteers working for the good of the community. Alsford has a fine heritage to preserve, and the market's history is a key feature in the town, which perhaps outsiders find difficult to understand. Pam Stevens, Trustee, New Alsford Town Trust.
Bill Hode has written about stress-free, not where I live. Traffic surveys compiled by insurance companies provide, like an oracle, the esoteric answers to the question, how does your traffic flow? The drivers may be stress-free, but not so the poor pedestrians who find the would-be simple act of crossing the road stressful. The traffic not only flows into the city, but constantly, mainly because there's nowhere to park. I'd like to know when Direct Line conducted their survey, as I can't think it was between 8 a.m. and 9:30 a.m. or 5 and 6 p.m. Where I live, the traffic during these periods could in no circumstances be described as flowing, and a quick survey of the drivers would hardly return a verdict of stress-free. Thank you, Direct Line, for your input, and Professor Turner for a splendid avuncular synopsis of its content. Your thoughts that people worry far too much about coming into the city might possibly hinge on the notion that they might not get out again or be able to park. One comforting thought is that the traffic's free flowing through the town is daily raising the already horrendous pollution levels. Bill Hode, Worthy Lane, Winchester.
And thank you, everyone, for those letters. If you have an opinion or a subject you'd like to air in the Hampshire Chronicle, you can contact them on 01962 860 836. That's 01962 860 836. Or email news@hampshirechronicle.co.uk. That's all lowercase, Hampshire Chronicle, one word. Or you could also write to the editor at 5 Upper Brook Street, Winchester, SO23 8AL. Well, we're still on with the views of local people, and Jerry has your say for this week, please.
And the Chronicle asked members of the public, the inflation rate fell to 1.5% in May. Are you feeling the effects of a better economy? Cliff Foster, 27, sales associate of Badger Farm, said, I suppose so. There's definitely more money in the pocket, which means more money to spend. You can see that around the high street as well, because there are more people spending. Alison Goss, 50, occupational therapist of Downside Road Week, said, not really. I've just had to have a new clutch in my car and it cost me £800. I can't say I've noticed a change. Terry Shanahan, 62, newsagent of Hyde Street, said, most people seem to be more positive about the economy than they have been for a while. 18 months ago, they were looking on the downside, but now I think they're looking on the upside. And Isabel Fletcher, 22, student of Fox Lane, Stanmore, said, I'm not sure. I don't feel like it's affected me, and I still feel the same about money as I usually do.
Thank you, Jerry. It's editorial comment now, and the editor has clearly referred to the energy drinks as his item for this week. It's headed Hidden Dangers of These Fizzy Drinks. A Winchester head teacher is to be commended for making a stand against the overconsumption of high-energy drinks by pupils in his school. It will highlight to parents and the youngster themselves of the dangers of highly caffeinated and sugary drinks like Red Bull and Lucozade. There are fears these drinks can affect the behaviour and performance of pupils when consumed in large quantities. Matthew Leeming of King's School said he is worried about the effects on pupils' heart rate, behaviour and focus in lessons. Some of the 680ml cans contain the equivalent of 21 teaspoons of sugar and as much caffeine as 3 cups of coffee. Some parents and pupils may be puzzled by the threat of detention if children are caught with these drinks, but they shouldn't be. Government adviser John Vincent called for them to be banned from schools, saying the drinks were effectively another form of drugs. There is also the concern that pupils are spending a large chunk of their lunch money on them instead of buying nutritious meals. Mr. Leeming's actions should act as a wake-up call to parents. And the next item we have is first person, and Robin's going to read that today.
And first person this week is by George Hayter and has the title Credit Crisis Was Writing on the Wall for a Quiet Read. I've been moaning again, this time about the library. I went in for a browse but could not concentrate on any book I leafed through. That's because half a dozen people were sat round a table in the middle of the room holding a meeting. The six seemed oblivious to the noise they made as they carried on a discussion as if they were in a seminar space or a boardroom. In fact, they were broadcasting their thoughts in the midst of innocent people like me, trying to enjoy the written word in an otherwise peaceful, open-plan public library, reminding me of what my daughter told me 2 years ago about her efforts to study for her degree in this same library at Chandler's Ford. The noise then, she told me, had been laughter from a mother and child group. There was nowhere quiet for young people to study, my daughter lamented, and she urged me to write about the problem in the Chronicle. I didn't do that, but now I was riled by my own cacophonous encounter. I determined to take action. I strode up to the desk and made my displeasure known to the member of staff. She didn't seem surprised by my rant, which, remembering I was in a library, I kept almost to a whisper. She handed me a comment card. Next day, I received a prompt response to what I had written. Unfortunately, the modern public library is no longer the temple of silence that it used to be, said the email, which was from the library's assistant manager. He emailed that more noise was effectively the price we have to pay if we want to carry on having a library service. As he put it, when libraries are subject to drastic budget cuts, while subject to enormous usage expectations, the service offer has to be broadened to also make it a community hub in which people do not just come in and borrow books or study, but can meet through clubs and societies and attend courses. There is also sometimes story times, rhyme times and children's activities running, which makes a library a very lively place indeed. We have no shame in admitting this, since, as I mentioned earlier, if we did not do that, you would no longer have a library to go to today. That's what I call a pretty effective explanation. Sympathetic, and then convincing, and even enjoyable. Everyone in Britain was warned when the credit crunch hit in 2008 that it would bring years of economic pain, and the painful cuts to libraries are part of that, along with inflation, unemployment, and lower real-term pay. Unless councils get richer, shh is gone from the bookshelves forever.
Thank you. Claire is going to read a Westminster diary, which is from George Hollingbury this week.
He's the MP for the Mearn Valley. And he says, the recent European election results have created a lot of column inches, but has anything really changed? Have parties of the right seized control of the steering wheel, or are they just a truculent passenger going along for the European ride? The truth, of course, is that it's difficult to know for sure, but there can be no doubt that Europe's electorates sent a very clear message to their traditional politicians. In large numbers, voters put their marks next to names that were not from the mainstream, and some of these parties are pretty extreme, if not downright unpleasant, in their views. For many of those voters, it will certainly have been about immigration and change they feel powerless to control. This view has been accentuated by continuing economic problems leaving many in difficult circumstances, particularly in the south of Europe. But does this really signal a shift to the right, an epochal moment? Or is it voters putting down a marker that they are very fed up with the usual political suspects? With apologies for hedging my bets, I think it's a little bit of both. Epochal because I honestly don't think that those in control of the European machine can any longer ignore the concerns of the citizens they allegedly serve. We can all make arguments that are pro-immigration, particularly when all the evidence shows that Europe is ageing, is less productive than it has ever been, and that economic growth is flat at best. That doesn't mean that we should march on regardless, ignoring the problems and tensions unfettered immigration causes, particularly to those at the bottom of the income scale. If the Eurocrats choose not to acknowledge the message they have been sent, then I have genuine fears for the future. But, to be clear, I think that many who voted for right-wing parties are keen to send a message and will be satisfied if they feel it has been heard by the mainstream. Most of those voting UKIP in the UK, I don't have enough experience of the other parties of the right across Europe to have a valid opinion of their intentions aren't after a revolution. They want politicians to understand that they feel put upon, are nervous of the change they see around them, and want to know their elected representatives get that. I hope we can persuade them that many of us do.
And Balgaram, the Chronicle's alternative look at the news, has a topical item in keeping with the centenary commemoration of the Great War. This first item of three that we're going to read is headed College Remembers Lost Generation in New Website. Winchester College has launched a new website to mark the centenary of the Great War. From 1914 to 1918, 488 pupils, teachers and choir boys served in the armed forces, and like other schools, Winchester lost a whole generation of young men, with 513 recorded deaths. Winchester College at War provides a biography of every school member who died. The website is the college's way of enabling users to explore the stories of the fallen and ensure they are not forgotten. Many of these young men went straight from the classroom to the officer training corps at Winchester, and then to the front line, where they faced a life expectancy of 6 weeks. Now, as part of the school's roll of honour, their stories will be told using information found in old records, regimental histories, and memoirs from a former staff member. Stories to find will include those of four men awarded the VC, the highest military honour, including Dennis Hewitt. The youngest from the college to be so honoured, Dennis, 19, from Hursley, was a second lieutenant in the Hampshire Regiment. On July the 31st, 1917, he survived the explosion of signal flares in his haversack and, despite being badly wounded, led his men forward to take their objective. But he was killed by a sniper as his company was setting up a machine gun post to protect the trenches they had just secured. Although buried near where he fell in Saint-Julien in the Ypres-Salion, his body was lost and he has no known grave. So he is commemorated in the College War Cloister, and there is a memorial at Hursley Church. Said Headmaster Dr. Ralph Townsend, "We are delighted to share this with a wider audience. It should prove a valuable tool for the students of military history and provide an historical insight into the contribution made by the pupils of this school." The college is offering guided tours of the cloister, the largest private war memorial, in Europe. You can phone 01962 621 152 for details. That number again, 01962 621152.
And the second item has the title A Law, But Not As We Know It. Let's do the maths. Every day, 80 vehicles break the law by driving through the semi-pedestrian precinct of Middlebrook Street and St George's Street in the Winchester city centre. That is 400 a week, excluding weekends. The statistics are based on a survey by this newspaper last month. An earlier survey by the Winchester Residents Association found 290 offenders in one day back in 2006. But sticking with the lower figure, that is around 20,000 vehicles a year. It has been going on for 20 years, so that is more than 400,000 breaches of the law. Very few of these offenders are stopped by the police.
Spending a penny won't cost the earth. Council bosses were flushed with pride when they revealed their new eco-toilets. Winchester City Council has installed a Propel Air system in the ladies' loos at the Guildhall, which flush using air and water. Each flush uses 80% less water, cutting the amount used by 762,119 litres a year. The council expects the toilets will save £38,500 in their 15-year life. Environment Chief Councillor Jan Warwick said, "I'm pleased we're able to save such a large amount as part of this relatively small refurbishment project. The amount saved is equivalent to filling up an Olympic-sized pool every 3 years. Visitors and customers can be reassured that when they spend a penny, it isn't costing the earth."
I think we're all dying to go and try those new toilets, aren't we? And that's it for our regular features this week. Thank you very much, everyone. And now it's time for What's On. So let's take a look at some of the entertainments in the region for you over the next couple of weeks. And where better to start in open gardens in this glorious weather we're having? Old Orsford House has opened its gardens. That's Old Orsford House in Colden Lane, Old Orsford. And it is on Wednesday, the 25th of June. It's an 18th century landscape, restored garden, 22-acre parkland, rare breeds, 13-acre gardens, and there's a perimeter woodland walk if you've got 30 minutes to spare. There's an illustrated talk by the owner at 11 a.m. and 2 p.m. That lasts about 40 minutes, so the opening times are 10 until 5 p.m. in the afternoon. Admission is £6, and there are plants for sale and teas. There are concerts to tell you about, two of them here. Friday the 27th of June, Romsey Youth Choir, Romsey Abbey, at 7:30. £7 for the under 18s and £4 from the Romsey Tourist Information. I'll give you an email address. That's janeahunt57. All lowercase, no spaces. janeahunt57@gmail.com. And then on the 28th of June, a summer concert at St Paul's Church. That's St Paul's Hill, Winchester, at 7:30. Carmen Suites 1 and 2, Eugenie Onegin excerpts, Borodin, and that's £10, £8 concession on the door, or you can book tickets at www.winchesterchamberorchestra, all one word, lowercase, winchesterchamberorchestra.org.uk. And if you're out and about, there are Winchester Cathedral tours on Friday the 27th of June, a First World War tour, Winchester Cathedral from 2 until 4 p.m. There's a guided tour of the cathedral and its World War I activity and commemoration. Tickets are £10, including a hot drink and cake from the cathedral box office. That's 01962 857 275. 01962 857 275. Or if you like to book online, it's winchester-cathedral.org.uk. And on Saturday, June the 28th, the now famous St Cross Fete at the Hospital of St Cross, St Cross Road, Winchester, 2 p.m. till 5 p.m, fun fair, train rides, refreshments, free parking. The adults are £2.50 admission and children are let in free. That number, 01962 851 375. 01962 851 375. And theatre and on stage. Well, the first is a plug for the Chesil Theatre, and they have an exciting open air production coming up of The Three Musketeers. It's headed a swashbuckling fun adventure for all the family. And it starts on the 8th of July, finishes on the 12th, that's the 8th to the 12th of July. 7:30 performances with a 2:30 matinee on the 8th of July. And this production is going up in the gardens of Wolsey, the Bishop's Palace, by kind permission of the Bishop of Winchester. You can book your tickets on chesiltheatre.org.uk, Chesil Theatre, one word, lowercase, .org.uk, telephone number 03 33 66 3366. That's 03 33 66 3366. And I'm sure you'll find that's a very exciting production to look forward to. And then at Winchester Guildhall on Friday and Saturday, June the 27th and 28th, Romeo and Juliet. That's at 7:30. The booking number there is 01962 840 500, and those tickets are £19 each. At the Nuffield in Southampton, The Great Gatsby, and that is from Saturday, until June the 21st at 7:30 p.m. And then The Pirates of Penzance, Tuesday to Saturday, June the 24th to the 28th at 7:30 p.m. The Great Gatsby and The Pirates of Penzance tickets can be booked at the box office on 02380 671771. 02380 671771. And that's it for What's On from us. And I've got one final announcement for you before we go to the main news, and that's the lighting up times. On Saturday, the 21st of June, lights will go on at 9:24 p.m. And on to Wednesday, the 25th of June, the lights go out at 4:51 a.m. and light up again at 9:24 p.m. And we're going to move on to the regular items of news for you. And Claire, starting it off, please, with your first item.
This is an article about the alpacas. And there's a picture of Derek and Hazel Brown above the article with their alpacas. The owner of an animal sanctuary left devastated after two runaway dogs savagely attacked his animals fears they will strike again now they have been returned to their owners. Derek Brown, who runs the Hensting Alpaca Sanctuary in Ossulbury, said he could not believe that the Labradors were allowed back home, where they had escaped from in the first place. As previously reported, the dogs ripped apart 76 chickens and left four heavily pregnant alpacas worth around £3,000 each with serious injuries after getting onto the farm. Police arrived at the scene and seized both the dogs, but they have been given back to their owners, who were away at the time of the incident nearly a fortnight ago. Worried that the dogs will escape again, Mr. Brown said he was worried that a child could be their next victim. He added, "I cannot believe that these dogs have been allowed back to their owners. They have escaped so many times, so they will attack again. They have a taste for it now, and I fear for who they will attack next. These dogs need to be put down before anyone else is hurt." Police confirmed that the dogs have been released back to their owners, but added that they only seized the dogs in this instance because the owners were away at the time of the incident. They added that it is not usual practice for police to seize dogs in cases like this. Their investigation into the incident continues. Mr. Brown, who said the attack on his animals will cost him around £20,000, is now looking to take action, legal action, to get the dogs destroyed.
"We don't want fracking here," conference told. Representatives from Hampshire communities came together in Winchester to thrash out growing concerns over fracking. Friends of the Earth told a conference in the city that the extraction of shale gas and oil is an unnecessary gamble, while Frack Fees Free Solent warned of pollution. The warnings came after Southampton Test MP Alan Whitehead predicted residents will lose their chance to block fracking under their homes if changes to trespass laws outlined in the Queen's speech come into force. As previously reported, Hampshire is a shale gas hotspot, with 8 drilling licences for possible fracking already issued to gas companies at sites across the county. At the conference, attended by 200 people at the Guild Hall, Brenda Pollock of Friends of the Earth said, "We believe that it is a gamble that we do not need to take. It is an unnecessary gamble, and it has not been welcomed by our local communities. Our view is that good regulation can make fracking safer, but it cannot actually make fracking safe. The reality is that communities don't want it. The local people don't have very much faith in regulators. They don't want sweeteners from the government. They want to enjoy their quality of life." Meanwhile, Tim Dawes of the Green Party and anti-fracking organisation Frack Free Solent said that if fracking took place in the south, Hampshire would be polluted with leaking frack fluid, methane, heavy metals and radioactive materials, while residents are subjected to constant noise from machinery. The event also featured talks on the process of fracking and the procedure companies need to go through to gain permission to extract shale gas and oil by the University of Southampton, Hampshire County Council, government bodies and UKOOG, which represents the UK onshore oil and gas industry. Councillor Sean Woodward said, "I'm in favour of finding out if there is a usable source of gas under Hampshire, because every homeowner or business owner will tell you that energy prices are shocking, so anything we can do to generate our own supply of energy is very important. If Hampshire has a production site for energy, then of course that is going to bring prosperity to local communities." The conference was organised by Hampshire County Council, Southampton City Council, the New Forest National Park Authority and Portsmouth City Council.
How City's Jews were airbrushed from its history. An investigation to rediscover Winchester's ignored Jewish past is gathering pace. Students from the University of Winchester are hoping to unearth the city's Jewish history, which stretches back more than 800 years after it was wiped from the record. The project began in April, and now its senior lecturer in theology and religious studies, Dr. Christina Welsh, will lead four students through a vast amount of data. The project explores a largely missing aspect of the city's past and allows tourists and locals to learn about its medieval Jewish history, including a woman who was effectively banker to the king. Time Team presenter and postdoctoral researcher Dr. Alice Langlands will help students piece together the city's medieval past. Earlier this year, the Chronicle revealed there was no mention of the city's Jewish heritage in the City Museum or the Great Hall, even though one of its main roads is called Jewry Street. Professor Tony Kushner of Southampton University, who first raised the issue, said, "This is most welcome and will help to restore the rightful place of Jewry in the history and memory of Winchester. It will helpfully explore the range of responses to the Jews in medieval Winchester, which included physical attack, expulsion, and regular accusations of ritual murder, as well as some moments of toleration. And on the Jewish side, that in spite of the wealth of some individuals, most were poor and marginal in society. In the future, Winchester's Jewish heritage will be better promoted in museums and dedicated visitor guides. A website will also be created. In the Middle Ages, Winchester had a thriving Jewish population, with one inhabitant noted as one of the country's wealthiest women, despite a fierce anti-Semitic climate. In 1290, King Edward I expelled the Jews from England. Winchester Castle even had a tower called the Jews' Tower, where they were imprisoned. Yet there's no mention of this in the permanent exhibition at the Great Hall, opened in the late 1990s.
This article is entitled "Son of Hampshire Who Fell on a Foreign Field." Focal point of remembrance services in Kingsworthy, the Bryce Stewart Memorial, was built by St Mary's Church in memory of a soldier killed in action. Now 100 years since the start of the Great War, a descendant of Lieutenant Bryce Stewart has travelled thousands of miles from the USA to find out more about his local connections. Peter Walker and his wife Meg Anderson from Massachusetts visited Kingsworthy during a six-week visit to Europe. Peter, a professor at Salem University, is a relative of Bryce Stewart's mother, Georgiana Walker. He discovered his connection when he was contacted by St. Mary's 2 years ago, prior to work being carried out on the memorial. They were met by Dennis Wellstead, who led the renovations, and Alex Hickman, who researched the family tree and the history of their home, Hinton House, for the Worthies' local history group. The couple were shown other tributes to Bryce Stewart, including a brass plaque in the church and a small wooden sign hidden in the choir stalls given by his nurse, Selina Hopkins. Bryce Stewart arrived in France in August 1914 as part of the British Expeditionary Force. He returned home briefly after being wounded at Ypres, but was killed in action and buried when he fell in Mesopotamia, present-day Iraq, in 1917. The memorial was funded by his parents as a tribute to their son. The names of their son and other villagers killed in the conflict were added to it. Said Peter Walker, "It's been very moving, and we are so grateful that people still take the trouble to renovate these memorials to keep them alive, especially now as we mark the centenary of the war. It makes me think of all the families torn apart by war. I can imagine what it must have been like for the Bryce Stewarts. I have always been interested in tracing my roots and to get a sense of where I came from." Mr. Walker later visited the recently restored Hinton House, the former family home, until it became part of Kingsworthy Primary School. He promised that he and other family members would return to the village to remember and pay tribute to Lieutenant Bryce Stewart. And there's a picture of Peter Walker and his wife Meg, and also Dennis Wellstead, who led the renovations, and the local historian Alex Hickman, I beg her pardon, by the memorial.
Honours for counties great and good. Queen's Birthday Honours recipients. The Queen's Birthday Honours have recognised the great and good around Hampshire. Some of those whose achievements and efforts have been rewarded include the man behind the revolutionary goal line technology introduced into Premier League football. Dr. Paul Martin Hawkins, who lives at Shawford and is MD and Chairman of Hawkeye Innovations, formerly based near Coldon Common, was awarded the OBE in the list announced last Saturday. He was working at Roke Manor Research in the late 1990s when he developed the Hawkeye system for tracking cricket balls. Professor Martin Biddle, a world-renowned archaeologist, has been granted a CBE for his services to archaeology. He led a number of famous digs in Winchester during the 1960s, 70s and 80s, and most recently was awarded a grant of £5,000 by the City Council to help publish the findings. Gardener's World broadcaster Roy Lancaster has become a CBE for his services to horticulture. It is the third time the 77-year-old from Chandler's Ford has been honoured. He was awarded the Victoria Medal of Honour in 1998 and an OBE in 1999. Neil Hopkins, former principal of Peter Simmons College, has been awarded an OBE for services to education. When he started in 1993, the sixth form college had 1,400 students, which has now more than doubled to around 3,500. Dr. Robert Sykes, head teacher at Thorndon School in Chandler's Ford, has been appointed a CBE. Tommy Geddes, the ombudsman at Winchester University, and Terry Sanderson, its director of lifelong learning and staff development, were both awarded MBEs for services to higher education. Derek Sweetenham, chairman of the Alresford and District Branch for the RAF Association, was awarded the British Empire Medal for services to the community and the Royal Air Forces Association. "I'm absolutely delighted and somewhat shocked by it, to be honest," he said. And the article is illustrated by four portraits, one of Dr. Paul Hawkins, one of Professor Martin Biddle, one of Neil Hopkins, and one of Tommy Geddes.
Molly dies, aged 108. Tributes have been paid to a woman who is thought to be Hampshire's oldest, who has died aged 108. Molly Green passed away peacefully on June the 2nd at her home in Christchurch Road, Winchester. Her life will be remembered at a special service at the Hospital of St. Cross on July the 4th by the family she left behind. Her two sons, John, 74, Edward, 70, and her daughter and son-in-law with whom she lived, Hermione, 77, and Ben Goulding, 86. Mrs. Goulding said, "Her mother and her grandmother both lived into their 90s. Above all, she loved chatting and throwing parties. Right up until last month, when she had people over from one of the nearby care homes for coffee, she was always very social." Mrs. Green was born on January the 15th, 1906, in London, and grew up in Southwark. She met her husband, Captain William Seeger Green, when she was 24 and he was 36, at a rugby match in 1928, and they were married in 1930. Molly and William moved to Bath when he retired in 1936, after he was made the Deputy Director of Ordnance. Mrs. Goulding added, "People have written to us talking about how amusing and entertaining she was. She leaves behind her grandchildren, Nicholas, Giles, Alice, Harriet, Anna, William, Sasha and Toby, and 12 great-grandchildren."
Angels thanked in Health Trust Nursing Awards. Inspirational nursing staff who have made a difference to people's lives have been honoured at an emotional award ceremony. The Director of Nursing Awards, now in its ninth year, recognises the individuals and teams of Hampshire Hospitals NHS Foundation Trust, HHFT, nursing staff who have shown extraordinary care and compassion to patients. Hundreds of nurses, midwives and healthcare assistants filled a marquee at the Eltham Hotel in Hartley Whitney to see staff at Basingstoke, Winchester and Andover hospitals formally recognised and thanked. There were a record 259 nominations from patients this year, with the winners picked up by a panel of judges, including governors of HHFT. The winners of the Rotary Club Awards each received an award and an invitation to dinner with the relevant Rotary Club, while the recipients of the individual awards were handed a £100 Virgin Experience voucher, and the winning teams each received £1,000. Donna Green, chief nurse at HHFT, said that her own recent stay in hospital had made her realise how vital good nursing care is to patients. She told the audience, "When I was in hospital, I wasn't worried about how many nurses there were or how nice they were. It was whether they could do their job. Nice but dim just doesn't cut it. I had a huge amount of respect for a nurse who said very honestly that she didn't know what to do and went to ask advice from a colleague. What you all do is incredibly important. You make a big difference to people's lives. Among the winners was Abby Lascelles, a physiotherapist at the Royal Hampshire County Hospital, who won the Allied Health Professional Award. She was nominated by Peter Roberts, who was treated by Abby when he was almost unable to walk because of pains in his joints and back. He said, "I really don't think I would still be here if Abby had not been there. She has given me the confidence to walk, to work, and to carry on." The Victoria Ward at RHCH, which specialises in caring for patients with gastrointestinal and endocrine disorders, picked up two awards, the Rotary Club of Winchester Award and the Maggie Wallace Award. Patients described staff there as very caring and attentive and committed. Elsewhere across the Health Trust, Alison Jupp, a junior sister on Ward C4 at Basingstoke Hospital, was named as the winner of the Individual Surgical Services Division category. Other team award winners were the C3 Ward and Isolation Ward at Basingstoke Hospital and the Anthony Letchworth Ward at the RHCH in Winchester. The Chief Medical Officer Award, chosen by Andrew Bishop, went to Susan Bellows, a play therapy assistant at RHCH, who said she was shocked to have won. Ms. Green thanked the guests before they left and said that next year, which will be the 10th anniversary of the Donor Awards, will be a very special event.
Villagers come out to support church funds. Villagers in Twyford turned out in numbers to support a fete in the church grounds. St. Mary the Virgin has held fetes before, most recently in the grounds of nearby Twyford Preparatory School. But last Saturday, it set up stalls in the old part of the churchyard around the yew tree. Blessed by fine weather, hundreds of people attended the event, helping to raise £2,600 for church funds. Ian Wheeler, Deputy Verger, said, "It was a lovely day. It went extremely well and was well supported." The belfry was open to the public and visitors had the chance to see the eight bells. One was rung during the fete. There were lots of things for children, such as lucky dips, Splat the Rat and other games. And the article is illustrated by three photographs, one of George Med and Martha Towler manning their fruit and veg stand, and another of Paul Martin, Fiona and Sophie Keeling and Kate Bittles at the water and wine stall, and then a picture of people browsing the bookstall.
Redgrave returns for SWVG. Oscar winner Vanessa Redgrave is appearing in a special one-night show in Winchester next month to raise funds for homeless refugees. It's the second time in less than a year the star of stage and screen has performed in the city to support Southampton and Winchester Visitors Group, SWVG, which befriends destitute asylum seekers. Tickets are now on sale for the evening, called Thoughts, Poems and Songs, in St John's Rooms, the Broadway, on Friday, July the 4th, starting at 6 p.m. The veteran star will be joined on stage by her actress daughter-in-law, Jennifer Wiltsey, and guitarist Mike Outram, a professor at Trinity College of Music. Redgrave raised more than £5,000 for the local charity last October when she spoke about her remarkable life and career in conversation with journalist Jenny Cuff at St Swithin's School. SWVG's Hazel Still said, "Vanessa was so moved by what she heard from the asylum seekers that she immediately wanted to help again." The tickets cost £12.50 for adults and £10 for students and are available from Jennifer Hassan on 07503 176 350.
the annual shipping festival service. Generations of sailors united to pay tribute to past and present naval men and women serving on the high seas. More than 200 people packed into Winchester Cathedral for the annual shipping festival service. Guests watched representatives from HMS King Alfred, the Royal Fleet Auxiliary, HM Coast Guard, Wasash Maritime Academy, and the Royal Logistics Corps carry in their ensigns. The Royal Naval Association, Royal Marines Association, and Merchant Navy Association also carried their standards, followed by youngsters from the Winchester, Southampton, and Portsmouth Sea Cadets Corps. Dignitaries included both Winchester and Southampton mayors, as well as the Deputy Lord Lieutenant for Hampshire, Rear Admiral Ian Henderson. The service, organised by the Southampton Master Mariners Club, was conducted by the Bishop of Southampton, the Right Reverend Jonathan Frost. And with this article, there's a picture of the Winchester Mayor, Eileen Berry, meeting the cadets, and another one of the flag bearers in the cathedral.
Green targets won't be met. Winchester civic chiefs are set to miss an ambitious green target. The City Council had wanted to cut its carbon emissions by 30% between 2004 and the end of 2015 and nurture the green economy. But City Council leader Rob Humby told the Cabinet the target would not be met, but that the Council was aiming to create 400 green jobs. It was unclear how far short of the target the Council will be. A spokesman later said the latest figures for 2011 and the Council should have been at 80% of the 2004 starting point, when in fact it was at around 87%.
Battle brings history to life. Two county groups are set to bring history to life with a reenactment of a historic battle near Alsford. The Battle of Cheriton project has teamed up with Hampshire Royal British Legion to stage a two-day event in memory of the 1644 clash near Alsford. History Through the Ages promises arena displays, military encampments, entertainments, stalls, and reenactments of the battle, which was fought in fields a short distance from the showground at Scrubs Farm near the village. Medieval archers and knights, English and American Civil War soldiers, Napoleonic armies, and World War II airborne forces will entertain an expected crowd of up to 10,000 people on the weekend of June the 28th to 29th. Council officials, Poppy Appeal fundraisers, members from the RBL's women's section and the Riders branch will all be found in the Legion's marquee. On Sunday, June the 29th, almost 1,000 reenactors will muster for a short commemorative service. Any profit made will help fund an archaeological dig at the historic battle site and swell the RBL's Poppy Appeal Fund.
Thank you very much, everyone. That concludes the Hampshire Chronicle extracts for you this week. And I need to give you a reminder again if you've got problems with your recording, and that's Irene Dowding. Her number is 01962 870370, 01962 870370. And again, we thank our editors, Keith and Linda, and also our hard-working copying, dispatch and memory stick preparation teams. And thank you also to our readers, Claire.
Bye.
Robin.
Goodbye.
Jerry.
Bye.
And from me, Roz, goodbye. Can you please put the memory stick in the wallet when you've finished with it and return it to us as soon as possible, putting the address label inside the wallet. Have a very good week, enjoy this lovely weather, and thank you for listening.